Imagine for a moment you run a global technology company. Now imagine you run a global technology company with trade policy changing every time you turn around. Welcome to Qualcomm. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday today, the 23rd of May. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Qualcomm in a bit, but we are going to start today with a little more on the banking bill the House passed yesterday, the one that loosens up some of the regulations on that industry passed after the financial crisis. And we're going to do it because you can draw a pretty straight line from the health of the banks to the health of this economy. And not just the big banks either. A lot of the supporters of the bill that the White House says President Trump is going to sign as soon as he can say it's going to help small and regional banks prosper. But as Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports, small is a lot bigger than it used to be.
Under current law, which will probably last another couple days, financial institutions with more than $50 billion in assets have to keep more cash in reserve than smaller banks. You've got your big Wall Street banks, but also a couple dozen others that may not seem so big.
Banks that were just above $50 billion that included Zions Bank in Utah and Huntington Bank, which is headquartered in Columbus, Ohio.
John Burlaw is with the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Under the new system, that $50 billion threshold becomes $250 billion, with some caveats.
If the Federal Reserve or other regulatory agencies find that this bank, you know, might be particularly problematic, they can still step in.
That's because some banks under that $250 billion limit are still pretty big players. Names like SunTrust Bank, American Express, Ally Financial, Charles Schwab. Sylvia Maxfield is dean of the Providence College School of Business.
Regional banks in the United States, community banks, and some subsidiaries of global banks no longer have to have such high capital requirements.
Carter Doherty at Americans for Financial Reform says this change could alter the landscape of the financial system.
You're going to see a lot more consolidation in the banking industry. This is going to be big banks buying up smaller banks to grow even larger.
But not so large that they're no longer considered small. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
There's a pharmaceutical story of note today, a little bit outside the norm for these kinds of stories. Under a bill passed by the House last night, also the Senate earlier and expected to be signed by the president, more terminally ill patients might be able to get their hands on experimental drugs. It's called Right to Try, designed to give patients who've exhausted all of their other options a little bit of hope. But as Marketplace's Amy Scott reports, it is not entirely clear how this federal law might work.
Most states already have right-to-try laws, thanks to a big push by the Goldwater Institute, a libertarian think tank. But the group's senior policy advisor, Starley Coleman, says there's one thing state laws can't do.
And that's tell the FDA what they can and can't do with the information that they collect from pharmaceutical companies about patients who are treated under state right-to-try laws.
And if something goes wrong, Coleman says the FDA can slow or shut down the approval process for that drug. Under the federal bill the House passed yesterday, the FDA would not be able to do that unless the commissioner had serious concerns. The FDA already allows terminally ill patients who don't qualify for clinical trials to receive experimental treatments through its expanded access program. But Richard Garr, former CEO of the biotech company NeuralStem Inc., says drug companies have been reluctant to participate because of the risks.
Even though it isn't your fault or might not be the type of patient that the drug would eventually be approved for, the FDA still would have the right to stop the trial.
But in reality, that rarely happens, according to Allison Bateman House, an assistant professor of medical ethics at NYU School of Medicine. She says the FDA audited 10 years of clinical trials.
And found only two times in 10 years that a death in expanded access ever led to a trial being temporarily closed down.
Bateman House says taking the FDA out of the process isn't likely to expand access and could put patients at risk. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, a long, slow climb to the upside. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Today's conversation from the corner office, the interviews we do with the people running the companies that shape our lives, is pulled straight from the headlines, as it were. Stephen Mollenkopf is the CEO of Qualcomm, a company that's been in the headlines a bit of late, what with news of takeover bids and trade wars. Mr. Mollenkopf came up from the company's headquarters in San Diego the other day, and when we sat down in the studio, I started with the basics, which was what exactly it is that Qualcomm does.
We're the company that invents the technology that is used to create cellular. So we are one of the few companies that creates the key things that make the cellular industry happen.
So a lot of people will hear that and think, chips. They make chips. What's the big deal?
We do make chips. We also do the fundamental research that allows the ecosystem to develop. So you try to figure out who does all the work that allows you to make a phone call anywhere in the world to anywhere else in the world. And Qualcomm's been a big piece of that for 30 years.
You're making literally bet the company bets, right? On what's going to happen in 10, 15, 20, 30 years. And yet now you are in a geopolitical environment where you don't know if we're having a trade war with China or not. You don't know what telecommunications policy is going to be. You don't know whether the president of the United States is going to help a Chinese telecommunications manufacturer to save Chinese jobs. How do you keep your head on straight?
Well, the balancing factor is if you have knowledge that the technology that you're working on is going to be relevant, regardless of how those near-term decisions, political decisions are made, you tend to have some confidence. So, for example, for Qualcomm, we actually feel like we have a seat at the table on both sides of the trade dispute or debate or
whatever
we're calling,
yeah,
calling it. And the reason why we feel that is we know that the technology we work on is going to be important to the Chinese, going to be important to the United States, going to be important to Europe. So we tend to feel like we have a good position.
We're talking a lot about China because obviously it's in the news. Do we worry too much about China, do you think? What are we not paying attention to because we're paying so much attention to the Chinese?
Well, it's like any other thing. I think it's quite diverse. So, for example,
your threat matrix, as it were, right?
Yeah. But if you looked at what we worry about in China, it's very different from what a lot of other people would worry about or voice or even what people tend to say is behind, let's say, the trade discussions.
Yes.
We have a different set of requirements when we talk about what could be improved in the relationship than aluminum or you know, another type of company that doesn't have market access. We have market access. We have good IP protection there. We have discussions about the price. But otherwise, we have a very good and a solid business there. But of course, there's always things to be worked on.
2.5G.
Well,
there will be people listening to this program who've heard 5G and are still going to be like, so what? So what?
Well, I would say it's coming to them very soon.
What's it going to do for me?
In the near term, it's going to allow you to get more video, more places, and at better cost points. This is the early phases of 5G. It will also enable a company like Verizon to compete with a cable company. But ultimately, you're going to see a lot of things like self-driving cars, just a tremendous amount of IoT and secure services.
Internet of Things.
Yeah, Internet of Things. But when people talk about the Internet of Things, it almost doesn't mean anything because it's so wide.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you look at it from a Qualcomm point of view, the track record of creating technologies that open up new business opportunities is pretty high.
Does any of that give you pause, the strength and the power and the possibilities of the technology we're building today?
First of all, it's exciting to work on. Engineers.
Oh, I bet.
Obviously.
But is there a little piece of you that goes,
There's a responsibility to make sure that the technologies that you create have the proper, and the word's not safeguards, but they have the proper technology built in so that it's used appropriately. Then the question is, how do we make sure public policy is ready for these technologies? Meaning that we try to encourage lawmakers, we educate lawmakers, we make sure that they know these are the type of things that people will be able to do with the technology, so get ready for it.
Do you think lawmakers understand?
They do. You know, it's...
Did you see them with Zuckerberg and the Facebook questions? Come on, man.
Well, I would say this. When you talk to lawmakers about the ramifications of the technologies, like a company like we make, they pretty instantly get it. And then the question is, how do you do the legislation? And that's not a technical problem, unfortunately.
So how are we doing in our technology policy?
I think we're doing pretty well. And as much as people talk about it, the environment is incredibly ripe to continue to innovate. Now, I answer that from the perspective of a company that is building fundamental technologies that are being used really by other companies. We don't have all of the data privacy and sort of the some of the issues that are in the news today. So we avoid that just by where we are in the ecosystem. But from our perspective, I mean, the number of new technologies and the relevancy of the things you're working on has never been higher.
Steve Mollenkopf, CEO of Qualcomm. Steve, thanks for coming into the studio. I appreciate it.
Kai, I appreciate it. Thank you.
That was, what, 5 minutes plus or minus of my conversation with Steve Mollenkopf. We went 22 in all. There's a whole lot more about what he's thinking about our technological future. Also, more on 5G and how that is going to change our lives. It's all on our Corner Office podcast. If you think the Federal Reserve has its hands full trying to manage this economy, well, central bankers in Argentina and Turkey would like a word with you. The Federal Reserve released the minutes of its most recent meeting today. Everything is basically fine, is the executive summary. Meanwhile, the Central Bank of Argentina met yesterday and kept its benchmark interest rate steady at 40. That is 40%. And in Ankara today, the Turkish Central Bank, in the face of some political pressure, held an emergency meeting to prop up the lira. The Turkish currency at one point was down 5% against the U.S. dollar, its biggest loss in nearly a decade. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson has the backstory and what it might mean for some other emerging economies.
One thing international investors really don't like when politicians try to influence their central bankers. President Erdogan said recently he wants more control over the central bank if he wins re-election next month. Gunul Tol is director of the Center for Turkish Studies at the Middle East Institute. She says Erdogan has a very unorthodox view of economic policy.
He thinks that high interest rates are to blame for Turkey's persistently high inflation.
Economists argue the opposite, that raising interest rates would help keep Turkey's double-digit inflation in check. So it is notable that Turkey's central bank did raise rates 3% today to 16.5%. But that's not nearly enough, says Steve Henke at Johns Hopkins University.
They'd have to go up roughly to the 40 to 50% range and stay there for quite some time to get the lira stabilized and get inflation stabilized.
Which would likely send the economy into recession. Another problem for Turkey and other emerging markets is that their companies and governments have borrowed lots of dollars and euros. So payment on that debt gets more expensive as their currencies weaken. Torsten Slok is chief international economist at Deutsche Bank.
So in some sense, the spiral of first the exchange rate going down is just setting in motion a whole host of macroeconomic challenges that are incredibly difficult.
So Slok says this is also opening up new debates on the stability of other emerging markets in Asia and Latin America. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Substantial amount of every penny I bring in goes straight to paying back debt, for sure.
Congratulations and welcome to the economy class of 2018. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials inched up 0.2% today, 52 points, 24,886. The S&P 500 picked up about 0.3%, 8 points, 2733. NASDAQ climbed 0.6%, 47 points, 74.25. Their Target is blaming its weaker-than-expected profits for the first quarter on lousy spring weather. Target shares cooled, losing 5.6%. Tiffany had a better day, way better. Shares of the jeweler soared more than 23% after it blew past estimates for the first quarter, raised its full-year forecast as well. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.99% today. You're listening to Marketplace. On Corner Office, you're going to hear stuff you're not going to hear anyplace else. Travel tips from Arnie Sorensen of Marriott.
Always be on local time. Always get natural light. Always exercise.
This memory from Joanna Coles at Hearst.
A magazine to me was like a finger beckoning me to the future.
And Microsoft's Satya Nadella on why it's personal.
I mean, he's in a hospital bed managed with devices and software that we built.
Listen to my conversations with them and more on the Corner Office podcast. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. If they haven't yet, I'm pretty sure business schools are soon going to be tapping into a rich new case study series. What companies do when their product is legal in much of the country at the state level, but still illegal under federal law. Medical and/or recreational marijuana is what we're talking about here. We're also talking about a business proposition in the multi-billions of dollars, a revenue stream that is made Byzantine by the whole legal-illegal conundrum, which is why this week a couple hundred people descended on Capitol Hill for the 8th annual Cannabis Industry Association's Lobby Days to make their case. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer reports.
Hear that? It's an industrial fan whirring away in the lower level of a Washington office building, just outside the door to the National Holistic Healing Center. It's important to keep air moving to disperse any telltale odors coming from inside. Holistic is a perfectly legal medical marijuana clinic in D.C. It was started a few years ago by Shonda Macias, a cell biologist.
Great to meet you.
I meet Macias in a conference room because without a medical marijuana card, I can't get into her clinic, which is filled with more than 100 products, strains of marijuana with names like Lemon Skunk and Blue Shark, cannabis-laced Rice Krispie treats and granola, plus tinctures and oils. Holistic is a multi-million dollar business, and
we're mostly a cash business.
Not by choice. Federal law prohibits the clinic from taking credit or debit cards. On a busy day, it'll take in $150,000 in cash, which is kept in a biometric safe that can be opened only with a fingerprint and special ID card. Twice a day, armed guards pick up the money and then deposit it at Holistic's bank. I'm not getting the name out of Macias.
I can't out the banks. Because then they'll shut them down.
It's most likely a community bank chartered by a state or D.C. where medical marijuana is legal. Federally chartered banks don't want to get anywhere near the marijuana business, even though Macias pays $2,000 a month in fees. She feels lucky to have a bank, especially since her business is growing.
When I opened the doors in 2015, we had two strains, and today we have over 150 different products.
Macias expects Holistic will bring in roughly $8 million this year, but a big chunk of it will go to taxes and expenses. Macias says Holistic could be much bigger and more profitable if it could operate like a typical business that wasn't illegal in the eyes of the federal government. She can't deduct many costs related to her business, like rent and parts of payroll, which is why Macias put on her charcoal gray suit and black pumps this week and trekked to Capitol Hill. Joining about 200 other cannabis business owners. These are citizen lobbyists, and this is Washington. So the day starts out with a group picture in front of the Capitol's reflecting pool.
All right, ready? One, two, three, big smiles. All right.
With the picture out of the way, Macias heads to Congressman Jody Heiss's office. Heiss is a Republican from Georgia, which just expanded its medical marijuana program. Macias sits down to wait.
I'm all nervous.
Finally, her group is ushered in to make their pitch to one of Heiss's staffers. They tout the medical benefits of cannabis, but point out how federal laws make it so difficult to run a business when you can't get a bank or take tax deductions.
So the payroll, again, paying cash, but also being competitive with wages. Our profit margin is so small.
That buzzer going off means a vote is being called. So Macias' group is ushered out.
Thank you. Thanks.
We appreciate your time.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Outside in the hall, they congratulate themselves for getting through the door.
Nice work, everybody.
The celebration may be a bit premature, though. The cannabis industry is lobbying for around a dozen bills. Not one is anywhere near a vote. So there's likely to be another group shot in front of the reflecting pool next year. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
With an eye toward the college graduation calendar, we're spending some time this week on the differing fates of graduating classes a decade apart. Yesterday, the not-so-lucky classes of 2008 and 2009, which came into the American workforce just as the Great Recession was heading towards its worst. Today on our series Divided Decade, the luckier people, job market-wise anyway, in the class of 2018. This spring, they've been wrapping up internships and interviewing at job fairs, and with unemployment at an 18-year low, things are looking, well, they're looking fine. Here's Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman.
I'm at the center of the University of Texas's flagship campus in Austin. It's a lovely spring day, and seniors parade past in their caps and gowns, snapping photos.
My name is Saul Rivera, and I'm about to graduate in astronomy.
Rivera grew up in a working-class suburb of Dallas. His father installs car alarms and runs a small store. His mom helps out on a food truck they own. Neither of his parents attended college. Rivera remembers tough times back in the Great Recession.
I would be hanging around a lot in my dad's shop, and when recession hit, it was just like empty for like months. My dad was starting to get worried, bills were starting to get an issue, and I kind of became more conscious about like how much I need to pay for university.
He says his parents have helped as much as they can. He's also gotten scholarships, financial aid, and racked up about $6,000 in student loans. He plans to go into science education with his astronomy degree.
Planetariums, museums, observatories.
Jobs that pay around $45,000 a year, a bit below average for new college graduates. Rivera's applied for positions nationwide, and though nothing's panned out yet...
I could say I'm pretty confident. If not, I do have backup plans, just like for the meanwhile. Some of my friends work at the airport, so they could give me a job there. If not, maybe just a part-time helping out my dad or a fast food place.
And that high level of confidence is justified for this generation of college grads. The job market's tight, skilled labor shortages are growing. Across Texas, recruiters are flocking to campuses to hire teachers, healthcare, finance, and energy workers, which will help graduates at a top state university like UT Austin, but also students at less academically selective and less expensive schools like Tarleton State.
The Student Center, all right, you'll go past the really big glass windows.
It's a regional branch of Texas A&M, a few hours north in the small town of Stephenville. And it's where Amy Kendall has just gotten her diploma.
When I came here, I was a nursing major.
And are you still?
I am not. I realized that wasn't the lifestyle I wanted, and anatomy is really hard, so.
Kendall quickly regrouped and set her sights on HR and career counseling. She says money was tight growing up, and she's attended Tarleton State on a full scholarship. She has her next steps all planned out.
Hopefully get a job on a college campus. Then I'm getting my master's in educational administration with an emphasis in higher education.
So she's gotten the memo about how important an advanced degree is for getting promoted and boosting your pay, which is important these days because the average entry-level salary for a college graduate has been flat since 2005 after adjusting for inflation, according to the National Association of Colleges and Employers. And even with a really good job market, making ends meet won't be easy for many graduates, as those who graduated a few years ago already know. When you ask them how the economy looks after college and professional school, they talk about juggling student loan payments and soaring rents, especially in the hot urban areas where job and career opportunities are booming. Kevin Hayes knows this well. He's a transplant from Texas to Portland, Oregon, who graduated from law school in 2015.
Prices are rising. A 500-square-foot apartment in a pretty junky building is going for $1,100 a month.
Hayes grew up near Dallas, worked at Starbucks to put himself through the University of North Texas, then moved to Portland to attend Lewis and Clark Law School. While setting up his own law practice, he's driven for Lyft to make extra cash.
As a transitional gig, bringing in some extra money and borrowing from future income in the expectation of getting a better paying position somewhere else later.
With massive student loans, he's still a long way from getting ahead financially. And he's in good company. Americans' total outstanding student loan debt has doubled in the past 10 years.
A substantial amount of every penny I bring in goes straight to paying back debt, for sure.
And how much do you have, like, roughly?
Oh, God. I believe it's $250,000.
Most of it racked up for that private university law school degree. Hayes says he thinks of it like a tax that he'll have to pay every month, it seems, for the rest of his life. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
We've got some statistics, by the way, on how graduating into a recession can hit you right in your paycheck. They're at marketplace.org/divided decade. This final note on the way out today from the United States District Court, Southern District of New York, Knight First Amendment Institute at Columbia University, et al. Plaintiffs against Donald J. Trump, et al. Defendants. Quote, this case requires us to consider whether a public official may, consistent with the First Amendment, block a person from his Twitter account in response to the political views that person has expressed, and whether the analysis differs because that public official is the President of the United States. The answer to both questions is no. End of quote. Not clearly, though, the last we're going to hear of this one. At Real Donald Trump is the Twitter account in question, by the way, in case you're curious. Anyway, we got to go. Markets were up today. Sarah Bergere, Jake Korski, Drew Jostat, Jeff Peters, Dan Powell, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.